This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Irene Carmone and Shauna Knizhnik, performed by Andy Arndt. Author's note. Hi, it's Irene. A book is always a collaborative process, even when there is only one name on the cover. And this one has two, so I thought I'd introduce the two of us and tell you how we did it. Shauna, then a law student, created the Notorious RBG Tumblr as a digital tribute to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she sparked an international phenomenon. I'm a journalist who interviewed RBG for MSNBC and will not try to wedge any more initials into this sentence. We are both hashtag millennials who like the internet but wanted to make something you could hold in your hands or at least keep on your device for longer than a browser tab. We both researched and reported the book. I wrote it, so if you see me, that's Irene. Shauna also curated the images and fact-checked. We drew on RBG's own words, including my interview with her in February 2015, as well as our interviews with her family members, close friends, colleagues, and clerks. We also dug deep into RBG's archive at the Library of Congress. We cite in the endnotes where we have gratefully relied on the reporting of others. Justice Ginsburg met with me in May 2015 to fact-check parts of the book, which involved both her patient generosity and my getting to text my boyfriend that a U.S. Marshal was coming for him. In homage to the notorious B.I.G., the chapter titles in this book are inspired by his lyrics. We thank his estate and Sony Music for permission to use them. Artist Maria Two-Fly Castillo, who also runs a women's graffiti collective, beautifully rendered each chapter title. Throughout the book, you'll find photographs, some previously unpublished, and the work of artists and creators moved to show their love for RBG. If you want to understand how an underestimated woman changed the world and is still out there doing the work, we got you. If you picked up this book only to learn how to get buff like an octogenarian who can do 20 push-ups, there's a chapter for you, too. We even were lucky enough to wrangle some of the most brilliant legal minds out there to help us annotate key passages from RBG's legal writing. RBG has been extraordinary all her life, but she never wanted to be a solo performer. She is committed to bringing up other women and underrepresented people, and to working together with her colleagues even when it seems impossible. We are frankly in awe of what we've learned about her, and we're pretty excited to share it with you. Chapter 1. Notorious. I just try to do the good job that I have to the best of my ability, and I really don't think about whether I'm inspirational. I just do the best I can. RBG, 2015. This is what you should look for on this 90-degree June morning. The broadcast news interns pairing running shoes with their summer business casual, hovering by the Supreme Court's public information office. They're waiting to clamber down the marble steps of the court to hand off the opinions to an on-air correspondent. You should count the number of boxes the court officers lay out, because each box holds one or two printed opinions. Big opinions get their own box. This contorted ritual exists because no cameras are allowed inside the court. It jealously guards its traditions and fears grandstanding. What happens inside the hushed chamber is pure theater. Below the friezes of Moses and Hammurabi, the buzz-cut U.S. Marshals scowl the visitors into silence. The justices still have ceramic spittoons at their feet. At 10 a.m. sharp, wait for the buzzer and watch everyone snap to their feet. As a marshal cries, "Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay," watch Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, known around the court as RBG, as she takes her seat at the winged mahogany bench. Look around her neck. When the jabot with scalloped glass beads glitters flat against the top of RBG's black robe, it's bad news for liberals. That's her descent collar. On June 25th, 2013, RBG's mirrored descent collar glinted blue and yellow in reflected light. By then, in her 9th decade of life and her 20th year on the court, RBG looked fragile and bowed, dwarfed by the black high-backed chair. But people who had counted her out when she had cancer were wrong both times. People who thought she couldn't go on after the death of Marty Ginsburg, her husband of 56 years, were wrong too. RBG still showed up to do the work of the court without missing a day. She still pulled all-nighters, leaving her clerks voicemails with instructions at 2 or 3 in the morning. The night before had been a long one. From RBG's perch, third from the right in order of seniority, she sometimes gazed up at the marble columns and wondered to herself if she was really there or if it were all a dream. But that Tuesday morning, her eyes were on her notes. The opinion was long finished, but she had something else to say, and she wanted to get it right. She scribbled intently as Justice Alito, seated to her left, read 2 opinions about a land use case and a bitter custody case involving Indian law. Those were not the cases the cameras were waiting for. It was a 2-box day. There was one more left. It was Chief Justice John Roberts's turn to announce an opinion he had assigned himself. The case was Shelby County versus Holder, a challenge to the constitutionality of a major portion of the Voting Rights Act. Roberts has an amiable Midwestern affect and a knack for simple but elegant phrases that had served him well when he was a lawyer arguing before the justices. "Any racial discrimination in voting is too much," Roberts declared that morning. "But our country has changed in the last 50 years. One of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation of the 20th century had been born of violent images, the faces of murdered civil rights activists in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Alabama state troopers shattering the skull of young John Lewis on a bridge in Selma. But for this new challenge to voting rights that came from 60 miles from Selma, Roberts had a more comforting picture to offer the country. High black voter turnout had elected Barack Obama. There were black mayors in Alabama and Mississippi. The protections Congress had reauthorized only a few years earlier were no longer justifiable. Racism was pretty much over now, and everyone could just move on. RBG waited quietly for her turn. Announcing a majority opinion in the court chamber is custom, but reading aloud in dissent is rare. It's like pulling the fire alarm, a public shaming of the majority that you want the world to hear. Only 24 hours earlier, RBG had sounded the alarm by reading 2 dissents from the bench, one in an affirmative action case and another for 2 workplace discrimination cases. As she had condemned the court's disregard for the realities of the workplace, Alito, who had written the majority opinion, had rolled his eyes and shook his head. His behavior was unheard-of disrespect at the court. On the morning of the voting rights case, the woman Alito had replaced, RBG's close friend Sandra Day O'Connor, sat in the section reserved for VIPs. Roberts said his piece, then added, evenly, "Justice Ginsburg has filed a dissenting opinion." RBG's voice had grown both raspier and fainter, but that morning there was no missing her passion. Alito sat frozen, holding his fist to his cheek. "The noble purpose of the Voting Rights Act," RBG said, "was to fight voter suppression that lingered, if more subtly. The court's conservative justices were supposed to care about restraint and defer to Congress, but they had wildly overstepped." "Hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the VRA," RBG had written in her opinion. "Killing the Voting Rights Act because it had worked too well," she had added, "was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet." At stake, RBG told the courtroom, was what was once the subject of a dream, the equal citizenship stature of all in our polity, a voice to every voter in our democracy, undiluted by race. It was an obvious reference to Martin Luther King's famous "I Have a Dream" speech, but the phrase "equal citizenship stature" has special meaning to RBG in particular. 40 years earlier, RBG had stood before a different set of justices and forced them to see that women were people too in the eyes of the Constitution. That women, along with men, deserved equal citizenship stature, to stand with all the rights and responsibilities that being a citizen meant. As part of a movement inspired by King's, RBG had gone from having doors slammed in her face to winning 5 out of 6 of the women's rights cases she argued before the Supreme Court. No one, not the firms and judges that had refused to hire a young mother, not the bosses who had forced her out of a job for getting pregnant or paid her less for being a woman, had ever expected her to be sitting up there at the court. RBG often repeated her mother's advice that getting angry was a waste of your own time. Even more often, she shared her mother-in-law's counsel for marriage, that sometimes it helped to be a little deaf. Those words had served her in the bad old days of blatant sexism, through the conservative backlash of the 80s, and on a court of people essentially stuck together for life. But lately, RBG was tired of pretending not to hear. Roberts had arrived with promises of compromise, but a few short years and a handful of 5-4 decisions were swiftly threatening the progress for which she had fought so hard. That 2012-2013 term, reading dissents from the bench in 5 cases, RBG broke a half-century-long record among all justices. Her dissent in the voting rights case was the last and the most furious. At nearly 10:30 a.m., RBG quoted Martin Luther King directly, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice," she said. But then she added her own words, "If there is a steadfast commitment to see the task through to completion." Not exactly poetry, but pure RBG. On or off the bench, she has always been steadfast, and when the work is justice, she has every intention to see it to the end. RBG has always been about doing the work. People wondered where the quiet and seemingly meek RBG had gone, where this firebrand had come from. But the truth is, that woman had always been there. You can't spell truth without Ruth. RBG had launched her protest from the bench on the morning of June 25th, hoping people outside the court would listen. They did. As it sunk in that the court had, in the words of civil rights hero and Congressman John Lewis, put a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act, progressives felt a mix of despair, fury, and admiration at how RBG had spoken up. "Everyone was angry on the internet at the same time," remembers Amina Toussaint. So and her friend Frank Chi were both young, D.C.-based digital strategists, used to channeling their frustrations into shareable objects. They wanted to do something. Chi spontaneously took a Simi Knox painting of RBG, with its cool, watchful eyes and taut mouth, and gave it a red background and a crown inspired by the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. So gave it words, "You can't spell truth without Ruth." They put it on Instagram, then plastered Washington with stickers. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, 26-year-old law student Hallie J. Pope started drawing. Her comic showed RBG patiently explaining to her colleagues what had gone wrong in each case that week. RBG finally loses it with Roberts's glib exclamation in Shelby, "LOL, racism is fixed!" Pope made an "I Heart RBG" shirt and donated the proceeds to a voting rights organization. And in New York, 24-year-old NYU law student Shauna Knizhnik was aghast at the gutting of voting rights. The only bright spot for her was the unfettered rage of Justice Ginsburg, or, as her classmate Ankur Mandania jokingly called her on Facebook, the notorious RBG. Inspired, Shauna took to Tumblr to create a tribute. To her, the reference to the 300-pound deceased rapper Notorious B.I.G. was both tongue-in-cheek and admiring. The humor was in the contrasts, the elite court and the streets, white and black, male and female, died too young and octogenarian. The woman who had never much wanted to make a stir, and the man who had left his mark. There were similarities, too. Brooklyn, like the swaggering lyricist, this tiny Jewish grandmother who demanded patience as she spoke could also pack a verbal punch. These appreciations were just the beginning. RBG, the woman once disdainfully referred to as school marmish, the wrong kind of feminist, a dinosaur, insufficiently radical, a dull writer, is now a fond hashtag. Her every utterance is clickbait, and according to the headlines, she no longer says anything, but rather eviscerates. At least two different notorious RBG signature cocktails can be drunk in two different cities. Turn on the Cartoon Network and you might glimpse an action figure named Wrath Hover Ginsbot, appointed for life to kick your butt. RBG's face is collaged, painted on fingernails, permanently tattooed on at least three arms, and emblazoned on Valentine's and greeting cards with cute puns. Hundreds of homemade RBG Halloween costumes come in baby and adult forms. By the spring of 2015, RBG was being name-checked anywhere a woman wanted to signal feminist smarts. By comedian Amy Schumer, by Lena Dunham on the show Scandal, and on The Good Wife. Comedian Kate McKinnon made RBG a recurring Saturday Night Live character, who crows each zinger, "You just got Ginsburned," and bumps to a hip-hop beat. "I just want to say that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is one of the most badass women in the world," So announces. "I think people who are no-nonsense people are rewarded greatly by the Internet." All this is, to use the court's language, without precedent. No other justice, however scrutinized or respected, has so captured the public's imagination. The public image of RBG in her over 30 years as a judge was as a restrained moderate. The people closest to RBG find her entrance to the zeitgeist hilarious, if perplexing. "It's hard for me to think of someone less likely to care about being a cult figure," says David Schizer, a former RBG clerk and now a friend. "I would not have thought of her as hip," says her son James. The adoring portrayal of an older woman like RBG as both fierce and knowing, pointed out the feminist author Rebecca Traister, is a crucial expansion of the American imagination with regard to powerful women. For too long, Traister says, older women have been reduced in our cultural consciousness to nanas, bubbies, or as ballbusters, nutcrackers, and bitches. RBG's old friend Gloria Steinem, who marvels at seeing the justice's image all over campuses, is happy to see RBG belie Steinem's own long-standing observation, "Women lose power with age, and men gain it." Historically, one way women have lost power is by being nudged out the door to make room for someone else. Not long before pop culture discovered RBG, liberal law professors and commentators began telling her the best thing she could do for what she cared about was to quit, so that Barack Obama could appoint a successor. RBG, ardently devoted to her job, has mostly brushed that dirt off her shoulder. Her refusal to meekly shuffle off the stage has been another public, high-stakes act of defiance. Seniority determines many of the court's functions, from the order in which justices speak in meetings to who gets to assign opinions. When Justice John Paul Stevens retired in 2010, RBG became the most senior of the court's liberals, a leadership role she has embraced. RBG stays because she loves her work, but also, it seems, because she thinks the court is headed in an alarming direction. After years of toil, often in the shadows, she is poised to explain to the country just what is going wrong. "I sense a shift in her willingness to be a public figure," RBG's former American Civil Liberties Union colleague Bert Newborn says. "Perhaps I am a little less tentative than I was when I was a new justice," RBG told the New Republic in 2014. But what really changed was the composition of the court. It was a polite way of saying the court had lurched to the right. RBG has never been one to shrink from a challenge. People who think she is hanging on to this world by a thread underestimate her. RBG's main concession to hitting her late 70s was to give up water skiing. Not a bomb thrower, but a bombshell achiever. Who is Ruth Bader Ginsburg? She takes her time, but nothing is lost on her. She's not just deliberative as a matter of principle, but as a matter of temperament, her friend, the critic Leon Wieseltier, has said. "A conversation with her is a special pleasure because there are no words that are not preceded by thoughts." She is wholly committed, above all, to the work of the court. Kathleen Paradis, who succeeded RBG as director of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU, said years ago, "Ruth is almost pure work. The anecdote that describes her best is that there are no anecdotes." The second part is not strictly true. She has survived tragedies and calamities. People have found her somber, but it is sometimes because her humor is so deadpan dry that it escapes many. She can be exacting, but rewards with loyalty and generosity. She had a passionate love affair with her husband that lasted almost 60 years. RBG is a woman who, to use another phrase that mattered a lot to her, defied stereotypes. When she was nominated to the Supreme Court, the Washington Post jointly interviewed two of her old ACLU colleagues, Paradis and former legal director Mel Wolf, and the pair struggled to explain RBG. "She's conventional, socially and politically and in every way, except for her intellect," Wolf said, a tad dismissively. Paradis cut in, "Yeah, but Mel, you have to admit it was pretty unconventional in those days for a woman to raise a family, hold a job, go to law school." Wolf, a man of the 1960s, shrugged. "I'll say this, she is by no means a bomb thrower," he insisted. "But," said Paradis, "the things she achieved were bombshells." Put another way, RBG was already a radical just by being herself, a woman who beat the odds to make her mark. Early in her career, RBG wanted to work at a law firm, maybe teach a little. The world as it was had no room for her. That injustice left her no choice but to achieve bombshells. It was easy to miss it, maybe because it didn't look like male bomb throwing. Or because she and her peers had transformed the world so much it was hard to remember, in retrospect and without living it, how hard it had been. And yet, as this audiobook's closer look at her life and work shows, RBG is about more than simply breaking glass ceilings to join a man's world. As the co-founder of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU, and often called the Thurgood Marshall of the women's rights movement, RBG devised careful, incremental plans for revolutionary goals. She imagined a world where men transformed themselves alongside women, and where sexual and reproductive freedom was grounded in women's equality, and then she worked to make it real. Many of her ideals, from the liberation of men to the valuing of caregivers, remain unrealized. RBG's longtime friend Cynthia Fuchs Epstein says, "I think had she not had this persona as this very soft-spoken, neat and tidy person with a conventional life, she would have been considered a flaming radical." If very few people realized these things about RBG, she had preferred to keep it that way. "She subordinated her own persona into this machine," says Newborn. "The star of every production she had was the law, not the lawyer." But the arrival of two Bush appointees to the court gave a narrow majority to a conservative agenda of undermining remedies for racial justice, reproductive rights, access to health care, and protections for workers, while giving corporations ever more rights and political influence. Even the current balance, tipped rightward with a chance of wobble, is precarious. The next president may appoint as many as 3 justices. RBG is determined to stick around and remind her colleagues and the country what she believes is America's unfinished promise. She likes to quote the opening words of the Constitution. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." Beautiful, yes, but as she always points out, we, the people, originally left out a lot of people. "It would not include me," RBG said, "or enslaved people, or Native Americans." Over the course of the centuries, people left out of the Constitution fought to have their humanity recognized by it. RBG sees that struggle as her life's work. Maybe that's why she's keeping herself in fighting shape in the meantime. In late November 2014, RBG felt a little faint during a workout session with her regular personal trainer and had surgery so a stent could be placed in her right coronary artery. But she had plans to keep. RBG had invited Shauna, Frank Chi, Amina Toussaint, and Ankur Mandania to visit the court. "I would be glad to greet the clever creators of the notorious RBG in chambers," she wrote. On December 10th, the morning of a two-hour oral argument about the Federal Tort Claims Act of 1946, the meme makers arrived. At around noon, they filed tentatively into her chambers, as each justice's personal domain is known. RBG stood, flanked by her clerks. Her slender wrist was slightly bruised from the heart stent procedure. Her guests asked her what message she had for all the young people who admired her. RBG paused to think it over. "You can tell them," she replied. "I'll be back doing push-ups next week." Chapter 2. Been in this game for years. 1828. Supreme Court justices bunk together until one lady ruins it for everyone by insisting on living with her husband. July 19th through 20th, 1848. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls. December 1853. Was invited to sit in the Chief Justice's seat. As I took the place, I involuntarily exclaimed, "Who knows, but this chair may one day be occupied by a woman." The brethren laughed heartily. Abolitionist feminist Sarah Grimke. July 28, 1868. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, recognizing the citizenship rights of ex-slaves, promises equal protection under the law, but makes it clear only men's voting rights count. April 15, 1873. The Supreme Court allows Illinois to block Myra Bradwell from practicing law just because she's a woman. In a 2011 reenactment of the case, RBG rules for Bradwell. The paramount destiny and mission of women are to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This is the law of the Creator. Justice Joseph P. Bradley, in a concurrence in Bradwell v. Illinois. The method of communication between the Creator and the jurist is never disclosed. RBG, brief to the Supreme Court, 1972. January 4th, 1897. A woman abducted from her home at gunpoint wasn't raped, the Supreme Court says in Mills v. United States, because for an act to be rape, more force is necessary. 1903. Celia Amster, RBG's mother, is born. August 18th, 1920. The 19th Amendment recognizes women's right to vote, though violent barriers remain for women of color. June 10th, 1932. Martin D. Ginsburg, future husband of RBG, is born. March 15th, 1933. Joan Ruth Bader, nicknamed Kiki, is born in Brooklyn. 1944. Lucille Lohman becomes the first female clerk at the Supreme Court. When you say you have no available graduates whom you could recommend for appointment as my clerk, do you include women? It is possible I may decide to take one, if I can find one who is absolutely first rate. Justice William O. Douglas, 1944. June 1950. Celia Bader dies one day before her daughter's high school graduation. Fall 1950. RBG enrolls at Cornell. 1953. Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex is published in the United States. May 17, 1954. In Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, the Supreme Court reverses itself on separate but equal. June 1954. Ruth Bader graduates from Cornell. She marries Marty at his family's home. July 21, 1955. Jane Ginsburg is born. 1956. RBG enrolls in Harvard Law School, one of only 9 women in her class. In her second year, Marty is diagnosed with cancer. The study of law was unusual for women of my generation. For most girls growing up in the 1940s, the most important degree was not your BA, but your MRS. RBG. 1958. Marty graduates from Harvard Law School. RBG transfers to Columbia University School of Law. 1959. RBG graduates from Columbia Law at the top of her class but can barely get a job. November 20, 1961. The Supreme Court signs off on making jury service optional because woman is still regarded as the center of home and family life. December 1962. Civil rights activist Pauli Murray proposes using the 14th Amendment to argue against sexist laws. 1963. RBG becomes the second woman to teach full-time at Rutgers School of Law. The dean explained it was only fair to pay me modestly, because my husband had a very good job. RBG. June 10, 1963. John F. Kennedy signs the Equal Pay Act, which bans discrimination in pay on the basis of sex. It's full of loopholes. July 2, 1964. President Lyndon Johnson signs into law the Civil Rights Act, which contains a last-minute ban on sex discrimination in employment. June 7, 1965. The Supreme Court finds that Connecticut's birth control law violates a right to marital privacy. 1965. RBG publishes her first book, Civil Procedure in Sweden, with Anders Berzelius. That's why when the Supreme Court faces a tricky question of Swedish civil procedure, we always go straight to Justice Ginsburg. Justice Elena Kagan. Unless sex discrimination is banned, the white women of this country would be drastically discriminated against in favor of a Negro woman. Representative Glenn Andrews of Alabama. September 8, 1965. RBG's son, James Ginsburg, is born. June 13, 1967. Lyndon Johnson nominates famed civil rights litigator Thurgood Marshall, and RBG inspiration, to be the first black justice of the Supreme Court. Spring 1970. RBG teaches her first class on women and the law. The Department of Justice, I am sure, doesn't have any male secretaries. They hire women secretaries because they are better. Chief Justice Warren Burger at oral argument for Phillips v. Martin Marietta, December 9, 1970. June 25, 1971. RBG writes her first brief to the Supreme Court in Reed v. Reed. January 1972. RBG becomes the first female tenured professor at Columbia Law School. Spring 1972. RBG co-founds the Women's Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. June 23, 1972. Richard Nixon signs into law Title IX, which bans sex discrimination in education. January 22, 1973. In Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, the Supreme Court makes abortion legal throughout the United States. RBG is uneasy about how the court got there. And how fast. This right of privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. Justice Harry Blackmun, Roe v. Wade. 1974. RBG publishes the first ever casebook on sex discrimination. She insists that the author's names be listed alphabetically, even though now the one man's name will come first. April 11, 1980. Jimmy Carter nominates RBG to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. August 19, 1981. Ronald Reagan nominates Sandra Day O'Connor to be the first woman on the Supreme Court. Male justices who had made noises over the years about resigning if a woman ever joined their ranks stay put. June 14, 1993. President Clinton nominates RBG to be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. May 13, 1994. Bill Clinton nominates Stephen Breyer to replace Harry Blackmun as Associate Justice. June 26, 1996. RBG writes the majority opinion in the landmark case United States v. Virginia, requiring the Virginia Military Institute to admit women. Summer 1999. RBG is diagnosed with colorectal cancer. She does not miss a day on the bench. December 12, 2000. RBG is one of four dissenters in Bush v. Gore, which effectively declares George W. Bush president. The wisdom of the court's decision to intervene and the wisdom of its ultimate determination await history's judgment. RBG, Bush v. Gore dissent. July 1, 2005. Sandra Day O'Connor announces her retirement. President Bush nominates D.C. Circuit Judge John Roberts as her replacement. To my sorrow, I am now what O'Connor was her first 12 years on the court, the lone woman. RBG. September 2005. Chief Justice Rehnquist, whom RBG would continue to call my chief, dies. Bush switches Roberts' nomination to Chief Justice and nominates Appeals Court Judge Samuel Alito to replace O'Connor. April 18, 2007. RBG launches her era of furious dissent with the abortion case Gonzalez v. Carhart. The court pretends that its decision protects women, RBG, summarizing her dissent from the bench. May 29, 2007. RBG reads her dissent from the bench in the sex discrimination case of Lilly Ledbetter. November 4, 2008. Barack Obama is elected the first black president.
I don't know. I hear that Justice Ginsburg has been working on her jump shot.
Barack Obama, after being invited to play basketball at the nation's highest court. February 5, 2009. RBG has surgery to remove a cancerous tumor. February 23, 2009. RBG is back on the bench. February 24, 2009. RBG attends Obama's first speech to Congress.
I wanted people to see that the Supreme Court isn't all male.
RBG. May 26, 2009. Obama nominates Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. She is the first Latina justice.
I like the idea that we're all over the bench. It says women are here to stay.
RBG. May 10, 2010. Obama nominates Solicitor General Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. June 27, 2010. Marty Ginsburg dies after complications from metastatic cancer. March 27, 2013. There's full marriage, and then there's sort of skim milk marriage. RBG at oral argument in United States v. Windsor, the successful challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act. June 25, 2013. As RBG dissents in a case gutting the Voting Rights Act, notorious RBG, the Tumblr, is born. August 2013. RBG becomes the first Supreme Court justice to officiate a same-sex wedding.
I think it will be one more statement that people who love each other and want to live together should be able to enjoy the blessings and the strife in the marriage relationship.
RBG. June 30th, 2014. In Burwell v. Hobby Lobby, the Supreme Court allows corporations to refuse contraceptive coverage to women based on the employer's religious belief. February 12th, 2015. RBG admits she was not 100% sober at the State of the Union. February 28th, 2015. RBG becomes a recurring character on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, issuing Ginsburns between dance moves. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook.
Chapter 3. I got a story to tell.
I feel like a very lucky girl who grew up in Brooklyn. RBG, 1996. The yearbook for James Madison High School's class of 1950 predicted that one senior would be a Supreme Court justice. As of this writing, Joel Scheinbaum is still practicing dentistry on Long Island. There was no particular prediction for Ruth Bader, nicknamed Kiki by her older sister. Having made it to the relative idol of Brooklyn, the Jewish parents of Flatbush longed to say, "My son the doctor, the lawyer," as Richard Saltzman, Kiki's classmate, remembered. The girls were supposed to marry doctors or lawyers. The yearbook entry for Ruth Bader shows a photo of a sweet-faced girl with bobbed hair. It notes that she was a cellist, that she twirled the baton, but not that she chipped her tooth once doing so, that she was in the Honors Society and treasurer of the Go-Getters Club. People remembered her as popular but quiet. She ran with a group of girls who were not very tall and chatted and seemed to have a good time, recalls another classmate, Hesh Kaplan. In summers at Camp Shinawa in the Adirondacks, she acquired the title of camp rabbi and met a nice boy who was bound for law school. In those days, some of the Irish, Italian, and Polish parents still thought there was a chance Jewish kids would make matzahs of their children's blood. Fights broke out in alleyways over Jews killing Christ. Kiki remembered a sign at a bed and breakfast in Pennsylvania, "No dogs or Jews allowed." But Brooklyn was a nice place to grow up. When Kiki got too old to be read to, her mother would drop her off at the library once a week and go get her hair done, while Kiki picked her 5 books of the week. For a while, her favorites were books about Greek and Norse mythology, and then she graduated to Nancy Drew. This was a girl who was an adventurer, who could think for herself, who was the dominant person in her relationship with her young boyfriend, RBG remembered happily. Because the library was one floor above a Chinese restaurant, I learned to love the smell of Chinese food in those days. The Catholics went to parochial school, the Jews to Madison. There wasn't much about Kiki that seemed different from the other kids. They rode their bikes to and from school. Their parents had tried to forget what had happened in Europe. They listened to the radio show and then watched the television version of The Goldbergs, with a Jewish mother who shouted out of windows like theirs sometimes did. They talked uneasily about Judy Copeland, the Madison graduate who was arrested for spying for the Soviets in Kiki's junior year, and wondered if this time the government was going after the Jews. What was different about Kiki was that she lived in a house that had the smell of death, as she later called it. Kiki told no one her mother had been slowly dying of cervical cancer since she was 13, or that her sister, Marilyn, had died of meningitis when Kiki was 2. But it was her secret to keep. She didn't want anyone feeling sorry for her. That same year, she turned 13, and Kiki's friends gathered over tobacco smoke and teased her that she wouldn't take a puff because she was scared of choking. Cigarettes were disgusting, she thought, but she would have no one thinking she was afraid. Her smoking habit lasted about 40 years. When her mother got very sick, Kiki tried to think about what would make her happy and settled on doing her homework by her mother's bed. She would not forget the time she had brought to her mother a less-than-perfect report card. That was the end of imperfect report cards. Celia Amster was born in New York 4 months after her family fled the Austro-Hungarian Empire. She was the 4th of 7 children, and at 15, she easily graduated from high school with top grades. Celia's parents had big dreams for her eldest brother. Each week, a chunk of Celia's earnings from working as a bookkeeper in Manhattan's garment district went to her brother's tuition at Cornell. When Celia married Nathan Bader, whose family had left a shtetl near pogrom-ravaged Odessa, and who had learned English in night school, that was the end of Celia working for money. It wouldn't do for a woman to keep working. People would think her husband couldn't support her, even if that was almost true when her husband's trade was fur during the Depression, and he'd never had much of a knack for business. Celia did help out a bit with the bookkeeping. Even as a young girl, Kiki could feel the sharpness of her mother's disappointment. Celia Amster Bader, her daughter would often say as an adult, was perhaps the most intelligent person she ever knew. By the end of high school, Kiki had not disappointed her mother. She'd gotten into Cornell, and her name was all over the high school graduation roster. Ruth Bader, English Scholarship Medal. Ruth Bader, New York State Scholarship. Ruth Bader, slated to speak as part of the Roundtable Forum of Honor. But Kiki never made it to graduation. On the day before the ceremony, her mother died. As the house on East 9th Street filled with mourning women, Kiki watched dully, because no woman counted for the minion, the the quorum of adults needed for a prayer under Jewish law. Kiki herself did not count. At Passover Seder, Kiki loved to ask the most questions, but no girls were allowed to join the boys studying for their bar mitzvahs. When Celia's mourners left and Nathan's business suffered without her disciplined eye, Nathan had to cut his donations to Temple Beth-El. The family was banished to the annex. Jewish law taught Kiki about a commitment to justice, but after her mother died, it took her a long time to see herself in the faith. Celia's instructions would remain carved in her daughter's memory. Ruth was to always be a lady. That meant always conduct yourself civilly. Don't let emotions like anger or envy get in your way, RBG later explained. Hold fast to your convictions and your self-respect. Be a good teacher, but don't snap back in anger. Anger, resentment, indulgence in recriminations waste time and sap energy. Few mothers of that time gave their daughters Celia's second piece of advice. Always be independent. This was a practical as well as philosophical admonition. After her death, Kiki learned Celia had quietly scraped together $8,000 for her daughter's education. Haunted by the Depression, when she had learned to never buy anything on credit, Celia had spread her savings across 5 banks with no more than $2,000 in each account. It was one of the most trying times in my life, but I knew that she wanted me to study hard and get good grades and succeed in life, RBG said later. So that's what I did. You could drop a bomb over her head. Not long after she had arrived in Ithaca, New York, in the fall of 1950, Kiki had created a mental map of every women's bathroom on the Cornell campus. The one in the architecture school was best. That's where she would smuggle books, going into a stall until her coursework was done. There were 4 men to every woman, and parents and daughters said aloud what a good place it was to find a man. Thanks to the competition for the spots reserved for women, RBG remembered, the women were a heck of a lot smarter than the men, but they hid their smarts. Kiki was hiding, too, mostly from the parties. No one, male or female, wanted to look serious, but she couldn't hide her intensity. You could drop a bomb over her head and she wouldn't know it, says Anita Fial, a high school classmate and her Cornell suitemate. 7 Jewish girls who had come from big cities lived along a corridor in Clara Dixon Hall and called themselves Clabbage for each of their initials. Kiki came first. After dinner on weeknights, the girls had to be indoors for the 10 p.m. curfew, ready for check-in. Girls had to live on campus, but boys were allowed to live in apartments in Ithaca, coming and going as they pleased. After curfew, the other girls of Clabbage played bridge on the floor, but Kiki would just keep working. Celia had wanted her daughter to be a teacher, a solid job for a woman. Kiki tried and then dropped student teaching. She preferred her European literature class with Vladimir Nabokov, then an unknown emigre who taught her to think carefully where each word should go. She chose government as her major and took an undergraduate class in constitutional law from the legendary professor Robert E. Cushman. Kiki had begun to notice things about the country in which she had felt lucky to have been born. World War II, which she later called a war against racism, had ended only 5 years before. I came to understand that our troops in that war were separated by race until the end, so there was something wrong about that, she said. There was something wrong with what happened her senior year, too. Marcus Singer, a professor of zoology at Cornell, was hauled before Senator Joseph McCarthy's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations and indicted for refusing to name fellow members of a Marxist study group. When Cornell stripped Singer of his teaching duties, the campus was in an uproar. Kiki was aghast. She'd begun working as a research assistant to Professor Cushman, helping him put together an exhibition on book burning. And here was censorship unfolding before her eyes. Cushman pointed out that lawyers had come to Singer's rescue. I got the idea that being a lawyer was a pretty good thing, RBG recalled. Because in addition to practicing a profession, you could do something good for your society. Her father, Nathan, worried about Kiki wanting to be a lawyer. So few women had made it. How would she support herself? He had reason to relent by the time she was a senior. His Kiki had, by then, found a good man to support her. She herself did not see it that way. Kiki was just happy that Marty Ginsburg, 1 year ahead of her at Cornell, was the first boy she ever met who cared that she had a brain. They had started out as good friends. Irma, the I in Clabbage, had a boyfriend who knew the famously wisecracking Marty. Marty had a girlfriend at Smith, and Kiki's boyfriend from Camp Shinawa went to Columbia Law School, so she saw him on weekends at best. Irma and her boyfriend thought introducing the two might mean the foursome could head to town in Marty's gray Chevy. Freed of the pressures of courting, Marty told Kiki everything on his mind. It was a good way to start a romantic relationship, which is what it became. There was a long, cold week at Cornell, RBG recalled. So that's how we started. It occurred to me that Martin D. Ginsburg was ever so much smarter than my boyfriend at Columbia Law School. Marty made up his mind much faster.
I have no doubt that in our case I liked her more first, he recalled.
Marty moved through the world with an easy confidence, tempered by an impish sense of humor. Ruth was a wonderful student and a beautiful young woman. Most of the men were in awe of her, but Marty was not. Carr Ferguson, a Cornell classmate and one of Marty's closest friends, remembered.
He's never been in awe of anybody. He wooed and won her by convincing her how much he respected her.
Where Kiki was shy and contained, Marty was the life of the party. His father, Morris, had risen through the garment industry to become vice president of Federated Department Stores. His mother, Evelyn, was an opera-goer who quickly took her son's motherless girlfriend under her wing. Kiki became a regular at the Ginsburg home on Long Island. She worked one summer at A&S, one of Federated's stores, and on those suburban streets, she failed her driving test 5 times before passing a 6th. Just because Evelyn didn't work outside the home didn't mean Marty expected the same from his future wife. He wanted them to marry and keep on working together at Harvard. His idea was, Marty later recalled, to be in the same discipline so there would be something you could talk about, bounce ideas off of, know what each other was doing.
And we actually sat down and by process of elimination came up with the law.
Marty had dropped his chemistry major because it interfered with golf practice, so medical school was out. Harvard Business School didn't accept women, so they settled on law.
I have thought deep in my heart, Marty would confess 40 years later, that Ruth always intended that to be the case.
They both made it into Harvard Law School. Marty, a year older, enrolled immediately while Kiki stayed in Ithaca to finish at Cornell. In June 1954, they married in the Ginsburgs' living room, just days after Kiki's graduation from Cornell. There were 18 people present, because in Judaism that number symbolizes life. Moments before the ceremony, as Ruth made last-minute arrangements, Evelyn asked her to come with her to the bedroom. "Dear," said Evelyn, whom Kiki would soon call Mother, "I'm going to tell you the secret of a happy marriage. It helps sometime to be a little deaf." In her outstretched hand were a pair of earplugs. It took some time for RBG to understand what Evelyn was trying to tell her. During the honeymoon in Europe, her first time outside of the country, it became clear. "My mother-in-law meant simply this," RBG said. "Sometimes people say unkind or thoughtless things, and when they do, it is best to be a little hard of hearing, to tune out and not snap back in anger or impatience." Cambridge would have to wait a little longer for the Ginsburgs. The U.S. Army had other plans for Marty, who had been in the Reserve Officers Training Corps in college. They were headed to Oklahoma for 2 years to live at the Fort Sill base. While Marty found he liked teaching at Fort Sill's artillery school, he had been good at golf and was good at shooting. RBG struggled. She worked at a law firm but couldn't type to save her life, so she took the civil service exam to work for the federal government. Workers were classified according to a general schedule, or GS, of earnings and responsibility. As a GS-5, RBG qualified to be a claims adjuster.
Then she innocently mentioned at the Social Security office that employed her that she was 3 months pregnant. Well, then, she was told, she couldn't possibly go to Baltimore for training. Her rank promptly dropped to GS-2, the lowest. Less money, less responsibility. Another Army wife in the office with a GS-5 rank was pregnant, too, RBG learned, but told no one until she had to. That woman went to Baltimore. But both women were expected to quit before they gave birth. Seeing the unfairness of petty bureaucracy and how it fell harder on some people's shoulders than others, RBG began bending the rules just a little. Week after week, she saw the same weathered faces coming in to try to register for Social Security, only to be sent back to look for the right papers. These visitors had no birth certificates, because when Native Americans had been born, no one official thought their births were worth recording. RBG silently decided that if someone looked 65, a hunting or fishing license would do. After 2 years in Oklahoma, RBG had to earn readmission to Harvard, and she got it. That was the easy part. Being a young mother on an Army base had been surprisingly easy. The officer's nursery started taking babies at 2 months and was open until midnight. But how could she handle law school as the mother of a toddler? Evelyn had often comforted her, but this time it was Morris's words that shook her out of her panic. "Ruth, if you don't want to go to law school, you have the best reason in the world and no one would think less of you," Morris said. "But if you really want to go to law school, you will stop feeling sorry for yourself. You will find a way." Ruth really wanted to go to law school. Something strange and singular. On a fall evening in 1956, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was happy to have something to do with her hands. She had made it through a stiff dinner at Harvard Law School Dean Irwin Griswold's house, and now wondered how long they would make small talk in a semicircle in Griswold's living room. Each of the 9 female students, all of the female students of their Harvard Law School class, had been paired with a professor. RBG shared an ashtray with the famous Professor Herbert Wexler. 40 years later, she would use uncharacteristically florid language to describe Wexler. "He seemed to me then, as he has ever since, to combine the power and beauty of the Greek gods Zeus and Apollo." Wexler was a chain smoker. RBG anxiously tapped out the ash. Soon she could go home to Marty and their daughter Jane, who had turned 1 in July. But Griswold wasn't ready to end the night. He wanted to savor the fact that he had, in his own telling, gotten women into Harvard Law School only 6 years earlier. RBG had just been relieved to see that Harvard was a place where women didn't hide their smarts. Before he let them go, Griswold had a question. "How?" he asked. "Could each of these female students justify taking the place of a man?" As the students reddened and shifted, RBG wanted to crawl under the couch. She had none of the sass of Flora Schnall, who coolly replied that she thought Harvard Law School would be a good place to find a husband. After all, once you subtracted Marty Ginsburg's wife, there were 8 Harvard Law women and around 500 men. Then it was RBG's turn. As she jerked to her feet to answer, the ashtray slid from her lap to the floor, scattering ashes on the carpet. No one moved. Griswold waited. "I wanted to know more about what my husband does," she mumbled, "so that I can be a sympathetic and understanding wife." If Griswold knew she was lying, he didn't let on. A faculty member later explained that it couldn't be true that women were discriminated against at the Harvard Law School. "We try to take people who have something unusual, something different about them," he said. "If you're a bull fiddle player, for example, you would get a plus. And if you're a woman, you would get a plus." RBG was left feeling like she and the other women were exotic animals in a menagerie. They were, as she later put it, something strange and singular. Every time she thought she could just do her work, RBG was reminded again that she didn't belong there. You felt in class as if all eyes were on you, and that if you didn't perform well, you would be failing not only for yourself, but for all women, RBG remembered. Some professors held Ladies' Day, when they would call only on women, with humiliating questions. RBG made law review, a distinction Marty hadn't managed. She was one of two women, roses amid the thorns, as a photographer put it, while positioning them on either side of the men of the Law Review. One night, near midnight, she found herself frantic inside Lamont Library.